Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Iraq's interim president says he will offer amnesty to insurgents who fought against the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq, but are willing to lay down their weapons now. The government is also expected to reinstitute the death penalty. Sheikh Ghazi al-Yawar told the Financial Times of London, "We are offering a silky hand to law-abiding people. We are offering a sharp sword to anybody who wants to be above the law." Vivian Walt covers Iraq for Time magazine and the Boston Globe. She joins us on the line from Baghdad. Vivian, why this offer to insurgents now?
Well, Robin, the government still has one big problem on their hands, and that is the thousands of people still in detention. Don't forget, these people were supposed to be transferred to the custody of the Iraqi government with the sovereignty handover, which was, more than 2 weeks ago now. But obviously they are fairly ill-equipped to deal with what is now, nearly 2,500 people in detention. So one thing they have to do is get people out of detention centers, and one way to do that is a general amnesty.
Is this also possibly a way to reach the insurgent down the street who, maybe hasn't done something heinous but would like to come back in the fold?
Yes, Robin. I mean, certainly they would want to appeal to a lot of people who were very antagonistic to the U.S. occupation and are now fairly hostile towards the new Iraqi government. By offering an amnesty, in a sense, it creates a break from the Americans and says, okay, now, we're going to start afresh and you guys are not our enemies anymore. You might have been the enemies of the Americans, but we don't see you that way. So, put down your weapons and be part of the new Iraq.
Any sense of how many might come forward under this new offer?
We have no idea, but I would think perhaps hundreds might, if they don't declare themselves openly, might at least feel themselves safe enough to be part of the process. I think until now there's been no political home for them. And what the president is now saying is, you're one of ours, come stop the fight and just, join in the political process, which is now getting underway.
But how is the government going to select which insurgent will get an amnesty and which will be tried?
Well, the president has put a kind of bar against those who committed what he called atrocious crimes. And in that category, he put murder, rape, obviously these terrible beheadings that have happened recently, those obviously are not going to get any kind of an amnesty and, in fact, could get the death penalty once he reinstates the death penalty. But there are a lot of people who were simply swept up in a very large kind of anti-American movement. And there are possibly, many hundreds of those or possibly even thousands of those. And by reaching out to them, he could possibly bring them in and, in a sense, defuse the insurgency, Robin. Mm.
We wondered, too, if along that same line, this might be a way of placating the homegrown insurgents, if you will, who we understand are increasingly angry at the foreign insurgency and appalled by things like car bombings and beheadings.
There does definitely seem to be a rift emerging between the local and the foreign insurgents. And we've seen this, we've heard this in a lot of the Friday prayer sermons from the hardcore sheikhs who in recent weeks have said, be careful not to regard every foreigner as your enemy. There are things we don't like that you are doing. And very much putting out the message that the foreign fighters seem to be the kind of people for whom there are no limits and that in a sense this is not okay with the Iraqi religious leaders. So the president's offer of amnesty very much plays into that rift and in a sense could really split the insurgency.
Vivian, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Vivian Walt covers Iraq for Time magazine and the Boston Globe. She spoke to us on the line from Baghdad.
The greatest threat to Afghanistan's safety and development lies not with Taliban insurgents, but with private militias, according to President Hamid Karzai. Only about 10,000 of an estimated 60,000 militiamen have been disarmed so far, and Karzai wants to do something about them before they can jeopardize parliamentary elections now scheduled for spring. Reporter Carlotta Gall covers Afghanistan for the New York Times. Carlotta, welcome.
Thank you.
Who is Karzai talking about when he refers to private militia leaders?
He's talking about what are commonly called warlords. They're really regional leaders, often very powerful in their province or in their area of their ethnic group. Most of them fought the Russians in the jihad against Soviet occupation here in the 80s, and many of them fought the Taliban as well. And so they've, since the fall of the Taliban, have retained their armed men, often on quite a loose basis. In other words, the men might be only part-time or might go back to their homes, but they're ready and armed and can be quickly brought together again if they're needed.
And is this something of a change in priorities for Karzai?
Always the great concern for the elections was whether they would get people registered, whether they would get it organized, and also the Taliban insurgency, which is very much going on in the south and the east, which is very violent insurgency. They have been targeting government workers and election workers in recent weeks, as well as American forces and even NGO workers, aid workers. So that has been the worry. But there was always a secondary worry that the local powerful warlords, if you wish, would try and influence the vote, especially for parliamentary elections where they want to win representation for themselves and their people, and that this would increase some local violence for the factional fighting or intimidation or individual fights between characters in the regions trying to get into parliament. And so this is why suddenly this week they announced a delay of the parliamentary elections for another 6 months. When we question everyone, the UN say it's technical, but in fact the real reason that has come out, and Karzai openly admitted this yesterday, it's the disarmament that failed. And these men are still around and very powerful and will influence the parliamentary election to a degree that will make a mockery of the whole process.
And Carlotta, when you asked President Karzai to rate his government on how well it had been doing, he only gave it a D, barely passing. It's unusual for a political leader anywhere to be so candid, and I wonder if you take this as a measure of his frustration.
I think they're just very frank where they're having difficulties and where they haven't done enough. And I think it comes from the Afghan people, actually, who are very demanding and very hopeful for better times.
And President Karzai also told you that they had tried to do this by persuasion, the disarmament of these various militia groups, and that hadn't worked, so now they had to use the stick. What sticks does he have?
Well, this is the great debate, and no one quite knows if he's going to succeed. When we asked him, well, what exactly are you going to do in the way of a stick, he hasn't got much of an idea. But I think what he was saying was that he really is running out of patience, and therefore he'll be more open in his criticisms of people. Maybe he'll try and get the foreign community here to help him in talking tough. But he's quite adamant that he doesn't want to confront in a military way. But I think it's he's trying to up the ante because he's realized this is a very serious problem.
Carlotta, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Carlotta Gall of the New York Times joined us on the line from Kabul.
American officials are considering a plan that would postpone presidential elections in the event of a major al-Qaeda attack this fall. That's according to an article in this week's Newsweek magazine. Joining us on the line is Newsweek reporter Michael Isikoff. Michael, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Well, this seems like a pretty unprecedented idea. What prompted it?
Well, as outlandish as it sounds, if you just focus for a moment on what they have been saying and listening closely to what they're saying, you realize it's not as out there as you might imagine. If Secretary Ridge last week went public with this terror threat warning that talked about intelligence that suggests that al-Qaeda might wish to disrupt the electoral process, he pointed, and others have pointed to the Madrid railway bombing and its successful influencing of the Spanish elections. That and other intelligence has led to more and more concerns about a fall attack and possibly even an election day attack. If that's the case, what happens? As we report, the chairman of this little known but newly created body, the Election Assistance Commission, is Ridden Ridge, pointing out that September 11th itself took place on a primary day, Democratic primary day in New York, mm-hmm. and it was promptly canceled by the State Board of Elections. The chairman of this commission pointed out that there is no federal entity that is empowered to make the same decision were there to be an attack on Election Day or Election Eve. As the Homeland Security people reviewed this, they realized he's right. And they have asked the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel to review this matter and figure out if there is any way that if there's an attack, there could be such a cancellation. This is part of broader contingency planning that's going on for Election Day by Homeland Security.
Well, as we know, many believe that the Madrid bombings affected the Spanish elections, at least the outcome of the elections. But this sounds like it's more about, affecting Election Day itself.
Well, look, the problem is, as we know, the intelligence is fragmentary, it's ambiguous, nobody's quite sure. But they do seem convinced that, number one, the Madrid bombing did embolden al-Qaeda and its affiliates and its sympathizers around the world. And two, that there is this rising chatter, increasing bits of intelligence suggesting that al-Qaeda is still out there and still does fall. So if that's the case, walk it through and play it out. And, there are lots of other different nightmarish scenarios. Let's just pick one that I didn't even have a chance to address in the piece, but let's say they get credible intelligence on the eve of the election that there might be an attack at polling stations.
Right. I was going to ask you.
Do they go public with that and risk the concern that they're going to be intimidating voters from showing up, or do they suppress it and then take the risk that there might, in fact, be such an attack? There's no easy answers to that one.
Well, but I was going to ask, is there any sense of a preemptive postponing because of word of an attack?
Look, I mean, this is going to spawn 1,000 conspiracy theories, and I can't imagine that any kind of action of that kind, absent a real and obvious threat that everybody would concede is there, such a step could be taken. Mm-hmm. I mean, people may be thinking about it, but it's not going to get very far. It would almost certainly require congressional approval. Congress sets Election Day. One can only imagine whether to be some sort of presidential unilateral decision. The kind of fuss, the furor that would result. I mean, it's almost off the charts. This is the land of conspiracy theories. Here we are talking about some pretty outlandish stuff. But that said, it is worth noting that people are taking this seriously. There's serious contingency planning and discussion going on about what to do in the event of an election attack.
Well, Michael, some might say just having a plan is, maybe it's time we did. Michael Isikoff, thank you so much.
Sure enough, anytime.
Michael writes for Newsweek magazine.
Just ahead, a rebel group in Chad is holding a man with ties to al-Qaeda. He's accused of kidnapping 32 European tourists. The rebels want to get rid of him. The U.S. wants him. So what's the holdup? I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The most wanted terrorist in North Africa has been held by Chadian rebels since March. The rebels want to hand Amari Saifi over to the U.S., and it certainly wants him, but there are other forces at play. Last week, Libya gave the Chadian rebels an ultimatum: hand over Saifi or suffer a bombing. But that deadline has passed with no repercussions. Amari Saifi leads the powerful Salafist Group for Preaching and Combat, North Africa's largest terrorist organization. And joining us with more on his story is New York Times correspondent Craig Smith in Agadir, Morocco. Craig, who is Amari Saifi?
He was a special forces paratrooper in the Algerian army who joined the Islamists who were fighting the government after...
His group wants an Islamic State in Algeria.
That's right. He's fighting for the creation of an Islamic State in Northern Africa, whether it be in Algeria or across a broader region. And he's particularly wanted because he's led a couple of very painful operations against the Algerians and against Europeans. One was the ambush of Algerian troops last year in which 43 soldiers died. And then he kidnapped 32 European tourists in the Sahara last year. Mm. One of those died, but the rest were released after Germany paid a ransom of nearly $6 million.
Which is said to fund his group.
That's right. He's used that money to recruit and to buy arms.
Well, we understand that U.S. forces have been training Chadian government forces in part to capture accused terrorists like Saifi. So how did he get into the hands of the anti-government Chadian rebels?
Well, the U.S. has a program called, they call the Pan-Sahel Initiative. The Sahel is this, this broad fringe of the Sahara Desert. That's very sparsely populated and has drawn certain terrorist elements because they can operate freely there and there's a lot of arms trading. So the U.S. has helped first Mali and then Niger and then Chad to track Amari Saifi and his band across the desert. And finally, the Chadian regular forces engaged him in the northwest of their country and killed a certain number of his followers, but he and 16 others got away and were on foot in a very remote area of northern Chad. It's a volcanic area with a very difficult area to survive in, and it's an area that's under the control of Chadian rebels, mm-hmm. and they picked him up.
Well, now, finally, why is Libya involved?
Well, the Chadian rebels picked him up, and then they started approaching everybody they knew who might want the guy, and they found it difficult to find takers because they are a rebel group, and most governments have relationships with the Chadian government and are reluctant to deal with the rebels. The Libyans were supposed to take these guys and then hand them over to the Germans, who have an international arrest warrant out for Saifi. But the rebels handed, as a good faith measure, handed over the two lieutenants to Amari Saifi, and then if all went well, they would hand him over and the rest of the captives. But it didn't go well. I mean, the Libyans didn't transfer those two men to the Germans and then made this threat against the Chadian rebels that either they turn the rest over or they'll face bombardment.
Which we hear has not happened, so we're at checkmate.
That's right, for the time being. I mean, now there's the danger is, as this goes on, the Salafist Group for Preaching and Combat, GSPC is the name of the group, has a lot of money. As we said earlier, they have this $6 million or some, presumably some portion of it remaining. And there's a concern that they'll make a deal with the rebels and spring the guy.
Craig Smith, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Craig Smith, correspondent for The New York Times, speaking to us from Morocco. Well, we now turn to Steve Simon. He's senior analyst at the RAND Corporation and co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror. Steve, you're hearing about this, as we said, checkmate. Why is this diplomatic dance so awkward? Why can't the U.S. go in and make a deal?
Well, consider who the parties are. You have the Libyans on the one hand, you have the Chadian government and Chadian rebels, and possibly one other North African player. This involves a bizarro world diplomacy, if you remember the old Superman comics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The mixture of deception, incompetence, and just plain weirdness when dealing with negotiating parties like this is bound to create huge complications.
This is such an odd story, Steve. Here you have an ally of the U.S. reportedly paying a ransom to a terrorist suspect, which in turn funds his organization. You've got a former enemy, Libya, attempting to help get the terrorist out of the area so he can be handed over to the West. You've got Chadian rebels who nobody ever would have heard of, I don't think. I mean, at least, you know, the average listener, except for this story. How do you think it will play out?
Look, I don't know. The Libyans, I think, want this guy because the Libyans have their own fundamentalist opposition that they want to deal with. And if they can get their hands on this guy and put the screws to them, I think they feel that they'll get information that's valuable to their own security. So they've got an incentive. They have a minor diplomatic incentive in that they can shore up ties to the United States that are, you know, far from robust, although, you know, they're far better than they were in the days of Pan Am 103 sanctions. So I wouldn't think that Amari Saifi is a key prize for the United States now. But nevertheless, the U.S. has an interest in ensuring a degree of stability in that Sahel area that Craig described, precisely because it is such a desirable refuge, not just for GSPC, but others. Hmm.
Steve Simon, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Steve Simon, senior analyst at RAND Corporation and co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush was at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory today in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. His topic, the War on Terror.
It's not possible to guarantee perfect security in our vast free nation. But I can assure our fellow Americans, many fine professionals in intelligence and national security and homeland security and law enforcement are working around the clock, doing everything they can to protect the country. And we're grateful to them all.
The president's speech today comes amid continuing fallout from Friday's release of a report from the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. That 521-page report was sharply critical of how the intelligence community assessed Saddam Hussein's power and intentions before the war. Joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. is Deborah Oren, Washington Bureau Chief for the New York Post. Deborah, welcome.
Hello.
And Andrea Stone, Congressional Correspondent for USA Today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
Deborah, I want to start with you. President Bush clearly took this opportunity to defend both the intelligence community and the war in Iraq. This certainly sounds like an issue that's not likely to go away anytime soon.
Now, what the president is doing is reiterating his position, and actually in a perhaps stronger way than he has been doing it recently. Perhaps the key line from that speech was this one: although we have not found stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction, we were right to go into Iraq. And then he ticked off a series of ways in which he said he has made America safer, and he was standing flanked with signs that said protecting America. The message was pretty clear. This is the issue, protecting America, on which the president holds the biggest edge in polls over John Kerry, and it's no accident that that's the issue that he's highlighting.
Andrea, can you remind us briefly what some of those specific criticisms of the Select Committee report on intelligence were?
Sure. The pre-war intelligence basically was bad. It was overstated. It was incomplete. It was misleading, according to the Senate report, and that the judgment that about Iraq's alleged nuclear, chemical, biological weapons programs were, not supported by the underlying intelligence, and that the CIA had a predisposition or a bias to take what information they did have and interpret it in the worst possible light as far as Saddam Hussein was concerned. And they also found another reason to go to war, connection between al-Qaeda, which was behind September 11th, the 11th attacks, and Saddam Hussein was just not supported. There was some kind of contact, but there was not a formal relationship, and there was no evidence that Iraq had anything to do with those attacks.
And, Andrea, I just want to ask you briefly about a couple of members of the committee were on the Sunday talk shows this weekend saying it's just too important to leave the selection of a new chief of intelligence until after the November elections. Do you think we'll be seeing a nominee? And if so, any idea as to who that might be?
It's interesting. There's two thoughts on this. Some people think that, yes, there has to be a permanent head of the CIA. But a lot of Democrats, and I think Senator Dianne Feinstein was on one of the shows this weekend. She's on the Intelligence Committee. And she was saying, you know, whoever the administration puts up is going to bear a lot of scrutiny from Democrats in Congress. The Democrats in Congress would rather see the whole intelligence apparatus reformed, restructured, before naming a new head of the Central Intelligence Agency. You know, there are 15 different agencies in the government that collect intelligence, and as we learned on September 11th, a lot of them, they don't talk to each other. And I think Democrats, I know I was speaking to Jane Harman, who's the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, and she is adamant that first you've got to fix the system before you put somebody in charge.
Well, Deborah, back to you as to how this is going to play out in the presidential campaign, because we heard John Kerry and John Edwards on 60 Minutes last night and elsewhere. They are obviously wanting to make intelligence failures about Iraq a central theme of their campaign. But is that risky, since, after all, both did vote in favor of the war, they say, based on what they knew at the time? And yet we also have the Republican head of the committee saying that if Congress knew then what it knows now, the war would not have been approved.
Well, it's an interesting balancing act for them to try to do. Vice President Cheney, in a speech today, accused them of campaign amnesia, noting that John Edwards actually went further than President Bush, actually publicly said that Iraq was an imminent threat. Both he and Kerry said they looked at the evidence and Iraq was one of the biggest threats facing America. So they looked at the same evidence that the president did, came to the same conclusion the president did, and now they want to make the case that, no, actually the president lied and made them do it. It's an interesting thing to try to do. It will certainly work with base Democrats who will believe anything of the president. But the question is whether it will work with the voters who will decide the election. And I think it may be a little bit of a difficult sell.
Andrea, what's your take on that?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that is a real problem for both Kerry and Edwards. But, you know, now the argument that they're making is that, as Deborah said, they were misled, and now, now that they know the facts after the Senate Intelligence Report and the 9/11 Commission, they're basically saying to the Republicans, okay, can't you admit you're wrong? That's sort of my take on it.
I also want to ask you both about gay marriage. That appears to be shaping up as another campaign issue, perhaps. There's a vote that could come in the Senate this week. And Liz Cheney, the vice president's wife, surprised a lot of people yesterday when she said that states should decide the matter instead of coming up with a federal amendment to the Constitution, which the Bush administration and her husband are in favor of. Now, the Cheneys have a daughter who's gay, so presumably this was a personal comment as much as a political one. But might it affect the Senate vote? Andrea?
It's interesting because that's exactly the stance that Kerry and Edwards are taking, that they say they both oppose gay marriage, but that the matter should be left to the states. There should not be a constitutional amendment, which right now looks like it will be voted on Wednesday. Dick Cheney, during his debate with Joe Lieberman in the 2000 campaign, also said that he thought this was a matter for the states. And, of course, he's changed his tune because he, after all, is the vice president, and he takes his marching orders from the top of the ticket. But as we heard from Liz Cheney, apparently in the Cheney household, at least, they think this should be left to the states.
And, Deborah, in the short time we have left, how do you think this is going to play out in the campaign?
Well, I think again, this is one of those things you have to watch and see how it plays out. The Bush people are walking a delicate line, so are the Kerry people. The Kerry people are trying to argue they're against it, even though they're not going to vote against it, which is a delicate balance, although there are plenty of Americans who agree they're against gay marriage but don't want a constitutional amendment. But the people who care about the issue, I don't think that washes. On the other hand, Bush has to be careful that he doesn't look intolerant.
All right. We'll have to leave it there for now. Thanks to you both.
My pleasure.
Deborah Orin is the D.C. Bureau Chief for the New York Post. Andrea Stone is Congressional Correspondent for USA Today.
Still to come, what happens when jazz artists play that funky bass line? Here now, music reviewer James Isaac looks at some recent releases.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Summer usually brings barbecue and grilling to mind, but not if you're Here and Now foodie Scott Haas. He's been thinking about the cuisine of the Sichuan province in China.
I'm inside the kitchen of Chili Garden, a Sichuan restaurant in Medford, Massachusetts, where it's dinner time and the smell of hot peppers is in the air. I'm here to find out more about what is Sichuan cooking. I'm here with Nancy Berliner, who's the curator of Chinese art at the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts. Nancy, tell me more about Sichuan food. It's Sichuan food is from the province of Sichuan.
Yes, Sichuan is in the southwest corner of China. Considered southern China, and the food is very spicy. And
when you say spicy, you mean hot spicy or spicy, or spicy because of what?
Sichuan cooking is known for two different types of spicy. One is called la, and one is called ma. Ma means numbing, and the flavor of that numbing comes from what's called a Sichuan peppercorn, which actually is not pepper. It's a seed that comes from an ash tree. And then the other spicy is la, which comes from the chili pepper.
Is it unique to China that this province has this spicy food? Or does all Chinese food have some spice to it?
There are other regions in China, such as Hunan, where Mao came from, where the food is also very spicy and very hot. But the Sichuan peppercorn is quite unique. And chili peppers, remember, actually come from South America and only came to China about 400 or 500 years ago.
Now, your name is Zhang?
Zhang.
Zhang, you're one of the owners of the restaurant?
Yes, I am.
Now, can you show me some of the peppers that Nancy was talking about?
Yeah.
I'm going to follow you back here near the hot oven. No,
This is chili powder.
That's chili powder.
Yeah, I know that. This is dry red pepper.
Dry red pepper. Do you have any fresh peppers?
Yes, we do. This is peppercorn.
Can I smell this?
Yes.
It smells very spicy.
This is peppercorn.
That's peppercorn. Now, are you from Sichuan province?
Yes, I am.
Did you grow up as a little girl eating this?
Yes.
Now, how old were you when you first had hot peppers?
I think it could be 2 or 3 years old.
And you didn't mind?
I didn't mind. I like it.
You liked it. Are there people in Sichuan province who cannot eat this food because it's too hot?
Yes, there are some people who came from northern or southern.
How about if you grew up and were born there, your grandparents are from there?
I think everyone likes spicy.
That's very strange.
Because of the weather.
What do you mean because of the weather?
The weather is kind of humid.
Uh-huh.
So people love the spicy and peppercorn. They feel comfortable with this in the humid area, you know.
Let me ask you, you're here in Medford, Massachusetts, serving very, very spicy food, which I like very much, but what has been the reaction of people who are not from China to this food in Medford?
I think a lot of people like it, and the reaction is very positive.
They don't say to you, oh, it's too hot.
Some people say it's hot, but we will tell them you can choose mild, even non-spicy.
Well, after all, if 2-year-olds in Sichuan are eating it, then why can't they, right?
Yes.
Here now, food guru Scott Haas with Zhang Hu, owner of the Chili Garden in Medford, Massachusetts, and Nancy Berliner, curator of Chinese art at the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
This news note, Iraq's interim president is promising to use what he called a very sharp sword to fight insurgents and anyone else threatening security there. Ghazi al-Yawar also said the interim government will announce an amnesty soon for some insurgents. But when that expires, al-Yawar said, he will work to have the death penalty reintroduced. Iraq was also on President Bush's mind today. Speaking about the war on terrorism at a government nuclear facility in Tennessee, Mr. Bush said again that he had made the right decision about Saddam Hussein.
So I had a choice to make. Either take the word of a madman or defend America. Given that choice, I will defend America every time.
Mr. Bush also said, however, that weapons of mass destruction have not been found in Iraq.
Funk adds a little spice to three new jazz CDs that are just out. So without further ado, we're joined by Grandmaster Jazz Critic James Isaacs. Hi, James.
How are you, Robin?
Funk, I think of Sly and the Family Stone, Parliament with George Clinton. What are you thinking about musically?
Well, I'm thinking here about the application of a more basic unit of rhythm to the Ching Chinga Ching jazz cadence.
Because funk is known for its bass line.
Its yes, it
strong
is. It's
bass
bottom.
Line. Oh, it's bottom.
Yeah.
That's right. It has a big bottom.
It does have a,
okay.
A profuse bottom.
Yes, it does. Well, the first CD you have for us is James Carter live at Baker's Keyboard Lounge.
Yep.
Tell us about that.
Well, James Carter is from Detroit. Baker's Keyboard Lounge is in Detroit, so this was a homecoming for the phenomenally talented, I was going to say young, he's not so young anymore, James Carter is 35, the one-man reed section, because he not only plays just about every reed known to man. On this album, though, he sticks to the more conventional alto, tenor, baritone, soprano, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, let's listen to the first track on the CD. The CD is called Trichotism.
It is, sometimes known as Trichrotism. It was written by a bass player and a very good one named Oscar Pettiford, bassist and composer. Carter plays soprano saxophone, and I don't know if it's exactly a funk rhythm, but it's not the traditional ching-ching-a-ding jazz line.
Let's listen. I'm not exactly hearing Hot Fun in the Summertime.
No.
Sly and the Family
no,
Stone,
not.
But you get a whiff of that in
no,
there.
No, it's not Make My Funk the P-Funk.
Trichotism from James Carter's new CD, live at Baker's Keyboard Lounge. When was this recorded?
June of 2001. James Carter, there's been some revisionist thinking on him, it seems to me. Some critics, some fans, whatever, are now a little disenchanted with him because they say he's bombastic, that he plays too much, that he's a show-off. I disagree. He's very exciting, especially live. I mean, he just blows the blues away, especially on this tune, Foot Patton. Now, here's the deal. You will hear not one, not two, not three, but four tenor saxophonists on this album backing James Carter.
Now I know more than one saxophone player is saxophonists.
Well, Dexter Gordon always called it people who played his instrument tenor saxophonists, you know, I guess to be humorous or something. I liked it. So.
Well, what is next on your list of CD picks?
Next is a supergroup, a jazz power trio, again with some funk underpinning. It's the John Scofield, Steve Swallow, Bill Stewart trio, and I was lucky enough to see them. When I heard this band live, I thought to myself as I watched and listened to Bill Stewart, maybe this is what an avalanche sounds like in a really hip mountain range. It just sounds like these boulders coming in, you know, when he's rolling from tom-tom to tom-tom and maintaining this unbelievable pulse on his cymbals. And meanwhile, Steve Swallow, he's got this kind of throb going. It's not such a clearly defined 1, 2, 3, 4 walking thing, but it just throbs, and John Scofield is doing his thing, burning over those two very distinct rhythmic patterns.
What are we listening to?
This is the one called Travel John. It's a Scofield original. He's a very accomplished composer in addition to being a wonderful soloist. And this illustrates more the straight-ahead jazz side at a very fast tempo. John Scofield, Steve Swallow, Bill Stewart.
Travel John from the new CD, John Scofield Trio Live En Route.
Just out on the Verve label, by the way.
And we want to hear some of this jazz funk that's on some of these CDs. They've got a jam on this one?
Well, John Scofield, in addition to being a, quote, jazz and, quote, guitar player, he has worked in the jam band context. He has also recorded in the funk context. This one is called Over Big Top, and I guess one could call it a prime chunk of jazz funk.
Do I hear a little homage in there?
Oh, absolutely. The godfather of soul, Mr. Please Please himself, the hardest working man in show business, James Brown. And what John Scofield has done on this original of his called Over Big Top is use the bass line from James Brown's Give It Up or Turn It Loose as the point of departure for improvisation.
Well, and in fact, last on your list is a reissue of an album that was first recorded in 1969.
A true oddity.
The James Brown's Soul on Top. What's so special about this reissue?
Well, for one thing, the album has been out of print for years and years and years. Verve has just reissued Soul on Top. What makes this album most interesting is James Brown singing some standards, like the one we'll hear in a few seconds, and hearing the cream of the crop of Hollywood studio jazz pros, arranged and conducted by Oliver Nelson, trying to adapt to the James Brown boogaloo, whatever you call that groove that was going on. Yeah, getting on the good foot. This is James Brown trying to be a Nat Cole / Billy Eckstine jazz - ballad singer. Very interesting.
Baby, when we walk hand in hand, the world becomes a wonderland. It's magic. How else can I explain those rainbows when there is no rain? It's magic. Do you hear me?
There are just times in here when James Brown cannot stop being James Brown.
Right. Well, you know, I wouldn't either.
It makes it so much fun. Oh,
right.
Yeah. I mean, who wouldn't?
Well, one reviewer called Soul on Top the funkier side of big band jazz.
Yes.
Well, James, a wonderful selection as usual. What shall we go out with?
Well, we're going to go out on a prime example, in this case, of the funkier side of big band jazz. This is Papa's Got a Brand New Bag, not the original, which came out in 1965 and was a big hit for James Brown, big hit single. These guys are not quite acclimated to playing in this style. I think they get it, you know, but it takes them a while to realize, holy bleep, I'm playing with James Brown.
James Isaac, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here now is Grandmaster Jazz Critic James Isaac. For more information on his funky jazz bits, check out our website here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, Stefano Katsonis, Andy Meyer, and Lorne Madelon. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Cindy Howes. Our web producer is Zach Christo. And our interns are Nick Weiss-Richmond, Hove Path, and Alexis Del Vecchio.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio
and join us again, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.